again to Sleeping Through Class. I'm Kevin Beato, and I'm joined by Brendan Horoho and Nick Rishkevitz. Today, for World History, we are discussing the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment. These are new ideas that challenge long-held beliefs. So we will be looking at things like Johannes Kepler, Galileo, Newton, and even some thinkers, philosophers like Voltaire, Hobbes, Locke, and how these relate to subsequent events. So, Brendan, we're talking about these new ideas challenging long-held beliefs. When we're talking about science, if we go back, the main thing that we talk about in this is going to be like Galileo, Copernicus. So what are some of these long-held beliefs? And, you know, like discuss Ptolemy, geocentric, heliocentric.
Okay, yeah, sure. So Ptolemy basically was a astronomer, and people back way in the day, they sort of assumed that the Earth was at the center of the universe, right? They were thinking, okay, obviously we're God's like favorite children, you know, we were created in God's, you know, vision. And so his idea basically said that the Earth was at the center of the universe, you know. So he lived around the year 100 AD. It was a really, really long time ago. And it became known as the geocentric model. Geo means Earth in Latin. And so this idea said that Earth is stationary at the middle of the universe. The sun circles around the Earth, which makes sense because if you look up into the sky, the sun comes up on the east and sets on the west, and then it does it over and over and over. So if you're standing still and you just watch the sun, it looks like it's circling around you. Logical. Then you're looking at all these planets and all these stars, and they seem to move around you as well. And so based on these like simple observations, Ptolemy and a bunch of other early astronomers thought that the Earth was stationary and all the other objects in the sky were in motion. The Roman Catholic Church accepted the geocentric model as correct. It basically reaffirms the beliefs that they had in the Bible, that you know, Earth was special, that people were special, that the intelligent designer God had created it this way. He had created the heavens for the people of Earth, and all this. So it really confirmed their beliefs.
So we have the geocentric model. Now, there's a different model that comes out many centuries later. Nick, could you discuss a little bit about your namesake, Nicholas Copernicus, and the heliocentric model?
Sure. So Nicholas Copernicus was a Polish astronomer. He was really interested in examining the skies above and you know, kind of the mysteries of that. And he became really interested in it in the year 1497, when he first witnessed a solar eclipse. And that actually inspired him to prove that it wasn't the Earth at the center of the universe, as people had believed for thousands of years. Instead, he argued that it was the sun at the center of the universe. And this was a big thing. Copernicus looks into this. He finds that the planets actually revolved around the sun, and the moon revolves around the Earth. You can kind of get that now because we have an understanding of gravity and gravitational pull. But he basically finds that the sun is the center of the universe, not the Earth. And that goes against this geocentric theory, which was really supported for a long period of time. It was the traditional belief. It was the belief that was held by the powerful Catholic Church at the time. So his findings kind of stirred things up a bit, and it makes it, you know, it's a bit of a challenge to the status quo. So his theory is called the heliocentric theory. Heliocentric means that the sun is at the center of the universe.
Thank you. And yeah, the Catholic Church really does not like Copernicus. They're not a fan of his work. And actually in 1616, they ban his writings because they don't like the idea that God did not put the Earth at the center of the universe. How dare he think that, and how dare anyone learn from this? But he is an influential character, and he does spawn this new wave of science. Brendan, could you talk to us a little bit about someone like Galileo and sort of how he advanced on Copernicus?
Yeah. So Galileo took this idea, right, that maybe the sun is at the center of the universe, and they start to look at these observations, right? They start to say, okay, not what is it do we believe, but what is it that we can observe? What can, and they're sort of starting to develop what would become the scientific method. But Galileo creates a telescope. And he looks up into the sky, and he originally they think that, you know, a bunch of these stars and a bunch of these planets are, you know, celestial beings, you know, sort of godlike, you know, structures up in the sky. And he's able to see, whoa, when I look up there, there are mountains, there are rivers, there are other features on the moon and on planets that are similar to the features that we have on Earth. And so he's starting to think maybe they're kind of similar to us rather than something different. Maybe we're not as special as we originally thought. And so he goes and he publishes all of his findings in a book that's called Starry Messenger. And so he publishes this book, and people are not really super excited about it. It goes against what the church believed was true. And so when he advocates for the heliocentric model and he says all these things, it basically is throwing the heliocentric model and his beliefs there in the face of the Roman Catholic Church. So the church is super duper upset about it. And in 1616, he is basically, you know, he's basically put in front of the church and they're saying, you need to recant. You need to say that this is not true, that, you know, you lied about this. And you need to go back on what you said. And he was like, no, I can't. It's the truth. So this happened in 1616 and again in 1633. And, you know, he basically said, I'd rather be under house arrest for the rest of my life. And that's what happened. The religious authorities, you know, basically banned him from going out into public. And so he was, you know, left in his home for the majority of the rest of his life.
So there's one more scientific figure that I think that we should be discussing here, someone who has a massive influence on future generations of scientists. Even prominent scientists of today constantly cite him as a major influencer, such as Neil deGrasse Tyson. We're talking about Sir Isaac Newton. Nick, could you please talk to us a little bit about Sir Isaac Newton? Why is he important? What does he do?
Sure. So Sir Isaac Newton, who is he? He is an English scientist, and he had a lot of curiosities like, you know, Copernicus and these other scientific thinkers that we look at this time about the world around him and how it worked. And one of the questions he had dealt with the idea of gravity. He was very influential in gravity and physics and things like that. So when I'm talking about Sir Isaac Newton with my students, I often give the example. I'll hold up an object, maybe a pen or a pencil, and I'll drop it to the ground, and I'll ask them, why did it fall to the ground? And the answer is gravity. So that would be one of the things that Sir Isaac Newton is credited with. He develops a law of universal gravitation. He basically says that every object in the universe attracts every other object with a force, and that is based off of the mass of those objects as well as the distance between those objects. So, you know, that helps to explain why bigger objects like the sun would be the object that the Earth is within the gravitational pull of. The sun is bigger than the Earth, so the Earth is attracted to the sun. That also can explain the relationship between the Earth and the moon. The Earth is bigger than the moon. That's why the moon goes around the Earth, because the Earth is larger and the moon is attracted to the Earth and stays within its gravitational pull. Newton also developed laws of motion in physics, and his three laws of motion are very well known. If you've ever taken a physics class, or even maybe in some general science classes, you may have learned about these. So his first law states that a body at rest will remain at rest, and a body in motion will remain in motion unless it is acted upon by an external force. So what that means is if something is sitting on the ground, unless a force acts upon it, it will remain in that position. His second law is the force acting on an object is equal to the mass of that object at times its that object times its acceleration. So force equals mass times acceleration. That's how you can determine the force that an object has. And then his third law is that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. So basically, that can kind of go along almost with the idea that energy is never created nor destroyed. It just sort of changes forms.
Brendan, could you please talk to us a little bit about some of these English philosophers who helped bring about changes in politics, like Thomas Hobbes or John Locke?
Thomas Hobbes was a really interesting guy, and Hobbes and Locke were basically these two that were opposed in a lot of different ways, and they disagreed on a lot of stuff. So one of the easiest ways that I teach it to my students is I sort of compare and contrast them. So Hobbes thought people were naturally selfish and were, you know, willing to fight with anyone for resources. I kind of think about it like a battle royale. Like if you're playing Fortnite or you're playing, you know, Call of Duty Warzone or something like that, everybody is dropped into the same universe. There's limited numbers of resources, and so everyone is willing to kill each other in order to look out for themselves. Whereas Locke sort of believed that, you know, people naturally wanted a government. They wanted protection. They wanted rules. They wanted to make sure that there was no chaos. So there's these sort of opposite beliefs. Whereas Hobbes is saying, you know, people are going to defend themselves. They're going to fight for themselves. Locke says, we actually don't want that. People don't enjoy that. So Hobbes believed that government, you know, Hobbes believed that people could choose their government and decide who would be the king. He believed that it would be best if all the power of the government was left in the hands of one man, right? We choose one person, we put them in charge. If that guy is good or if that guy is bad, well, that's too bad. We chose him, right? And so he sort of looks at it like that, whereas Locke believes that the government was there to serve the people. If it's not doing a good job, if it's not working for us, we can overthrow it, we can destroy it, we can modify it, we can do something to it, right? So it's these sort of different beliefs. There's the idea like, hey, if you don't like your bed, you know, get a new one. Whereas, you know, Hobbes sort of believes you made your bed, you're going to lie in it, right? So these guys are contrasting on everything. I think the really, you know, most succinct way to understand how they thought is to sort of look at what they said when it came to government. And Thomas Hobbes says, it's not wisdom, but authority that makes a law. So he's saying, you don't have to be the smartest guy, but as long as you rule with an iron fist, as long as people respect you, you're going to be a good leader, right? Because if you command their respect out of fear, you know, you're going to be able to enforce all the laws. Whereas if you look at, you know, the opposite side of the spectrum, John Locke is saying all mankind being equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. So he's saying, like, everybody should just try to live, you know, happily. They should try to, you know, do what they want. And as long as you're not infringing on anybody else's happiness or rights or liberty or health, you know, like, what's the harm in it, right? So he's saying, you know, we want to give up some freedoms to feel safe and everything, but wouldn't that be worth it? Wouldn't it be worth it if everybody gave up a little bit of power and we all felt safer for it?
Right, and I think with John Locke, one of the little tricks that I teach my students to remember him is that he believed that we had these three natural rights, the right to life, liberty, and property. And that's very similar to Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But I teach my students this little trick with Locke and his name. I say that he believed that the government's job was to lock up or protect your three natural rights, your right to life, your right to liberty, and your right to property. That's kind of how I teach them a little trick to remember what Locke's big idea is there.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Nick. And like those ideas of, you know, life, liberty, property, you know, Thomas Jefferson lifts those ideas. He, you know, borrows them basically when he's writing the Declaration of Independence, you know, for the United States. France, if you look at their Declaration on the Rights of Free Men, it's very similar. It's got a bunch of those ideas in there. And actually the Haitian Revolution too, where the slaves in Haiti rebelled and became free from the French, they had a lot of those ideas in their inspiration as well. So his ideas, you know, really sort of spread out over the centuries and inspired a lot of people.
Yes, and on top of people like John Locke influencing our founding fathers here in the United States, there's also French philosophers here who also influence him, which you sort of hinted at. For instance, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, We the People is taken right from him. Separation of Powers coming from Charles Montesquieu. Nick, could you elaborate a little bit more on some of these French philosophers, including Voltaire as well, on top of the ones I mentioned?
Sure. Yeah, and I can add on to those a little bit as well. So Rousseau, one of the big contributions that he gives is the idea of the social contract, and that is that in a society, we all enter into a sort of contract with the government. And the idea there is sort of along the lines of what John Locke talked about. We give up some of our freedoms in order for the government to protect our rights to life, liberty, and property. And the government has a responsibility on their end to look out for those people's rights and to not abuse them. So it's sort of a contract or an agreement between the two. The examples I like to give for my students is, for example, we give up certain freedoms. In a totally free society, you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. And I point out that in order to protect, for example, life, one of the things that's given up in society is drinking and driving. That's a perfect example of it, right? We don't have the right to do that because it puts other people in danger. So that is something that is given up. In a totally free society where people can do whatever they want, there's no rule against that. But in the idea of the social contract, the people agree we are not going to do that. If somebody does, they can be punished under the law. And in that case, that is the government sort of taking a step to protect your life. Voltaire, one of the big ideas I teach with Voltaire is that he believed very strongly in freedom of expression, which is important for our First Amendment. And then he also believed in the separation of church and state. So his big idea was that religion and government should not be intertwined. You shouldn't be told by your government what religion you should be believing or what religion you should be practicing. You should have the freedom to make that choice on your own. That's the idea of freedom of religion, that you can choose whether you would like to practice Christianity or Judaism or Islam, or if you would rather not practice a religion at all. He believed that that was more of a personal decision, and it wasn't the government's role to be involved in that. We also have Montesquieu, the idea of the separation of powers. So he looks at these ideas of people like Thomas Hobbes, who believes in a strong monarch, and even to a degree John Locke believed that you should have a strong and powerful government. And he says that it's not a good idea to have one strong king in charge, that if they have all of the power, they can be corrupt. So what his belief is that they should separate those powers, and we can see that in our government today. We have three branches of government. We have an executive branch, which is the president and the vice president, and the armed forces and stuff like that would fall under that category. Their job is to enforce the law. You have the legislative branch, which involves Congress, and their job is to legislate or make the laws. And then you have a judicial branch whose job it is to rule on the laws and make decisions that way. And they all have sort of checks and balances on each other, and that comes from Montesquieu's big idea, the idea that one person with total power is not a good thing. That power should be separated and divided so as to prevent abuse of power.
Yeah, and I also wanted to add in there that the idea of federalism, like separating power between the federal government and the states and the local government, is sort of like another example of what Montesquieu's talking about. You're splitting the power among these different entities to sort of split up who's in charge of what. So like, you know, if you look at the Bill of Rights, you have a bunch of things that the government is sort of responsible for, like the federal government. And then when you get towards the end, I think it's the 9th or 10th Amendment, they say that the states are in charge of everything else, right? The states are in charge of deciding, you know, education. They're in charge of deciding drinking ages, things like that. And so it's a great way of also splitting up different rules. Like, we think that the drinking age in the United States is 21, but in fact, it's actually each state passed a law to make it 21. In the 1980s, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving had to go and petition each state, and one by one, they raised their drinking ages from 18 up to 21 to try to reduce binge drinking and drunk driving, like Nick was alluding to.
thank you so much here, guys. Most of these Enlightenment ideas, they fly in the face of these monarchs who are reigning supreme across Europe. You have them in England, you got them in France, which is actually where our next episode is going to take place. It's 1789, and heads will roll during the French Revolution. So, for Nick and for Brendan, this is Kevin with Sleeping Through Class. Au revoir.